Now it came to pass, when Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and its king, so he had done to Ai and its king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them, that they feared greatly, because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all its men were mighty. Then Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent to Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhiah, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon, saying, "Come up to me and help me, that we may attack Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel." Therefore the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered together and went up, they and all their armies, and camped before Gibeon and made war against it. And the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua at the camp at Gilgal, saying, "Do not forsake your servants. Come up to us quickly. Save us and help us. For all the kings of the Amorites who dwell in the mountains have gathered together against us." So Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. And Yahweh said to Joshua, "Do not fear them, for I have delivered them into your hand. Not a man of them shall stand before you." Joshua therefore came upon them suddenly, having marched all night from Gilgal. So Yahweh routed them before Israel, killed them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, chased them along the road that goes to Beth-horon, and struck them down as far as Azekah and Makkedah. And it happened, as they fled before Israel and were on the descent of Beth-horon, that Yahweh cast down large hailstones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than the children of Israel killed with the sword. Then Joshua spoke to Yahweh in the day when Yahweh delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel, and he said in the sight of Israel, "Sun, stand still over Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Aijalon." So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, till the people had revenge upon their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. And there has been no day like that before it or after it that Yahweh heeded the voice of a man, for Yahweh fought for Israel. Then Joshua returned, and all Israel with him, to the camp at Gilgal. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated. Joshua 9 recorded the deceptions of the Gibeonites that led Israel to enter into covenant with them. As Isaac's blessing on Jacob had to stand despite the trickery that brought it about, so Israel's covenant with Gibeon had to stand. As the rulers of Israel explained to their complaining people, "We have sworn to them by Yahweh God of Israel, now therefore we may not touch them." As we noted last week, this covenant relationship served as a blessing to Gibeon, as subsequent history showed it to be one of the ways in which the Lord drew some of the Gentiles unto himself under the old covenant. Tonight we will see a shorter-term blessing for both Gibeon and Israel when this covenant is tested. We're going to explore this passage using an outline based on three significant events within it. First of all, an enemy alliance formed in verses 1 through 5. Secondly, a covenant tested in verse 6. And thirdly, a prayer answered in verses 7 through 15. An enemy alliance formed, a covenant tested, a prayer answered. Through Israel and her leader Joshua, though Israel and her leader Joshua figure prominently in this military drama, the key actor is Yahweh, the Lord God himself. He is the one who provides victory to Israel, and he does so in answer to prayer. This is the focus of the passage, which is reflected in the two-part title for our message. I sort of gave it two titles: Yahweh Warrior for Israel, or The Day God Heeded a Man. We'll begin with our first point, which is an enemy alliance formed in verses 1 through 5. Chapter 10 begins in a way that echoes the beginning of chapter 9. In chapter 9, verse 3, we read, "When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai." And in 10, verses 1 and 2, we read, "Now it came to pass when Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and its king, so he had done to Ai and its king. In both cases, inhabitants of the land of Canaan hear of the victorious exploits of Israel under the leadership of Joshua. However, they respond in very different ways. When the Gibeonites heard, they sought and succeeded in making a covenant with Israel, thereby ensuring that they would not suffer the same fate as Jericho and Ai. The king of Jerusalem, on the other hand, hears about the Israelite victories and of their covenant with Gibeon, and he chooses to fight against them by launching an attack on Gibeon. Now, this would be a good time to note the political situation in the land. I'm just going to read a few sentences from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. In invading Palestine, the Israelites were not attacking a single coherent state, but a country occupied by different peoples and divided, like Greece at a later period, into a number of communities, each consisting of little more than a single city and cultivated country around it. Now, this independence of the various city-states informs the phenomenon we see again and again in the book, and that is the forming of alliances against Israel. We saw such an alliance in chapter 9, uniting the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now we see a similar alliance form among some of the southern cities in the land. And the catalyst for this alliance is the linking of Israel and Gibeon and the threat they are perceived to offer to others in the land. 9:17 indicates the Gibeonites came from four cities: Gibeon, Shephira, Bearoth, and Kirjath-Jearim. Now, on the back of your handout, you have a bulletin. On the back of your bulletin, you have a map. And it will, I think, be helpful for us to glance at that from time to time. So if you look there at the right, you see Gilgal and Jericho. If you follow that little dotted arrow, you come to Gibeon. And around Gibeon, you see these other cities. Below it, a little bit to the west, Shephiroth is one of the cities. Up to the north, Bearoth, Kiriath-Jearim is a little bit further south. And these cities together were considered Gibeon. They kind of were united, it seems. Now, Gibeon and Israel united control of most of the central plain in Canaan, divided the cities in the north from the cities in the south. Now, this map only shows the south, but if you were to have a full map of Canaan, it would extend farther to the north. And if you trace a line from Gilgal and Jericho over to Gibeon and a little further, you can see that basically they have a straight line across the central plains that divide northern Canaan from lower Canaan. And this was a fearsome prospect for those in Jerusalem. We read in 10:2, they feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all its men were mighty. Now, Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, reasons that Gibeon, again, probably meaning this confederation of four cities, constituted a major military force. And if they were militarily to link up with Israel, they would be an even mightier force that would geographically make it impossible for those in the south to unite with those in the north and to form alliances against them. Furthermore, occupying that central plain would give them an ideal location to launch attacks either to the north or to the south. And this king's idea is to attack Gibeon directly and quickly, hoping to gain victory over it before Israel can come to its aid. Now, with that strategy in mind, he reaches out to other southern kings. We read in verses 3 through 5, "Then Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent to Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon, saying, 'Come up to me and help me, that we may attack Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel.' Therefore, the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered together and went up, they and all their armies, and camped before Gibeon and made war against it." Now, if you look at your map again, sort of to the right, south of Gibeon, you will see Jerusalem. Just for a sense of scale, Jerusalem is about 6 miles from Gibeon. And then to the south and to the west, you see the other cities that are mentioned. To the south, Hebron. To the west, Jarmuth. South of that, Lachish. South of even that, Eglon. And these are the cities. You see the solid lines show how those cities all sent their men to Jerusalem. And together, that force marched toward Gibeon in order to set an attack against it. Such is the enemy alliance that has arisen. And that brings us to a covenant tested in verse 6. Seeing enemy forces gathering for the attack, the Gibeonites appeal to their covenant partners, Israel. Verse 6, and the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua at the camp at Gilgal, saying, do not forsake your servants. Come up to us quickly. Save us and help us. For all the kings of the Amorites who dwell in the mountains have gathered together against us. Note how they identify themselves to Israel as your servants. Now, this is the language they had employed of themselves when they appealed to Israel in chapter 9. They use that language of servants in verses 8, verses 9, verses 11. And then they had actually been made their servants. Remember, they were given specific tasks to be woodcutters and water carriers, which were among the lowest jobs in Israel. Now, by appealing as their servants, they showed some humility, but the basis of their appeal was their covenant bond with Israel. Because of the covenant between them, Israel and Gibeon were sworn to mutual defense. If one was attacked, the other was supposed to come and aid them. And Gibeon now asked Israel to do just that, to act according to the covenant. Do not forsake your servants. Come up to us quickly. Save us and help us. Now remember that many people in Israel despised the Gibeonites for their deception. And chapter 9 showed us that the only reason they hadn't actually killed them was because their ruler said the covenant before Yahweh would not allow such action. But though they didn't kill the Gibeonites themselves, the question is, would they come to their aid to keep them from being slaughtered by others? This was the way in which the covenant was tested. And the sequel shows that Israel was faithful to that covenant. And this brings us to our third and really main section of the chapter, in which we are entitling A Prayer Answered, in verses 7 through 15. Joshua acts swiftly and in faithfulness to Israel's covenant with Gibeon, verse 7. So Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. As requested, Israel's army is quick on the march to Gibeon. And as they go, Joshua receives divine assurance. Verse 8, and Yahweh said to Joshua, do not fear them, for I have delivered them into your hand. Not a man of them shall stand before you. Now this statement echoes words of encouragement that Joshua was given at the very beginning of the book in his call to be a leader. The Lord says to him, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, the children of Israel. Verse 5, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. Or verse 9, have I not commanded you, be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid nor be dismayed, for Yahweh your God is with you wherever you go. Israel's faithfulness to their covenant with Gibeon is but a faint shadow of the far greater faithfulness of Yahweh to his covenant with Israel and their commander Joshua. Verse 9, Joshua therefore came upon them suddenly, having marched all night from Gilgal. Now on the map, you'll see that the distance from Gilgal to Gibeon is quite a bit greater than that between Jerusalem and Gibeon. In fact, it's about three times as long. It's about 18 miles that was covered. Now, in the last chapter, in chapter 9, verse 17, we're told that it took the Israelites 3 days to journey to Gibeon. Now the Israelite army covers the ground in a forced march of one night. And this was to give them the advantage of a surprise attack against the southern forces, who thought they would only be engaging with the Gibeonite forces. We read verse 10. So Yahweh routed them before Israel, killed them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, chased them along the road that goes to Beth-horon, and struck them down as far as Azekah and Makeda. Now note that the subject in this sentence is Yahweh. All the verbs are singular. Yahweh routed them. Yahweh killed them. Yahweh chased them. Yahweh struck them down. Now, Israel, of course, was involved, but the text wants to make it crystal clear that it was Yahweh, Israel's covenant Lord, who was the victorious warrior. Now, the text does not give us details about Israel's attack. It does give us the route by which they chased the southern forces. So if you look again at the map and start at Gibeon, and you follow the dotted line, you see they first chased them a bit northwest. They went through upper Beth Horam and around lower Beth Horam, and then they turned to the south, and they end up all the way down at Makeda and Azekah. That was the path by which they chased these retreating forces. Now, that does raise a question. Why did the forces not simply retreat to Jerusalem? That was much closer than this other route. And it suggests, though we cannot be certain, that perhaps Joshua did something here like he did at Ai. Perhaps when he came at night, he actually attacked from behind to drive the forces north. He could even have had a decoy up north like he did over Ai. And so rather than retreating to the south, which would be a natural thing, they had to go to the north and ultimately trace their way back down the south in a farther route. But in either case, it was quite a rout. But this was not primarily due to Joshua's strategy or to the might of the armies of Israel and Gibeon. For we read in verse 11, "And it happened, as they fled before Israel and were on the descent of Beth Horon, that Yahweh cast down large hailstones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than the children of Israel killed with the sword." Now, I'm reading from the New King James Version, and in the New King James Version, in this verse, the word hailstones appears twice. But that's actually not true to the original Hebrew. The first instance actually employs the word stones, just the word stones. And so here's a case where I think the ESV renders this more accurately. It says, "Yahweh threw down large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died." Okay, children, here's a Bible quiz for you. See if you've been paying attention during this series. Can you remember another incident earlier in the book of Joshua in which stones were thrown on someone until they died? That's right, Achan. Achan was stoned because he had taken of the spoil of Jericho contrary to the Lord's command. In that case, Israel stoned the covenant breaker within their midst. And here in chapter 10, Yahweh himself does the stoning against the enemies of his covenant people. And this is in accord with what we learned previously about the nature of holy warfare. Yahweh is faithful to his covenant promises to Abram and his seed. "I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you." It is a fearsome thing to turn against God and his people, and the southern forces learn that when they attack Gibeon. And I believe the word stones is used first in verse 11 to make this link back to Achan and to the big picture of God's covenant with Israel. You could do a very interesting word study of stones in the book of Joshua, because the memorial stones are also set up as covenant reminders. There's both covenant blessing and covenant curse that are symbolized in different ways by stones. But now that that is accomplished, the nature of the large stones from heaven is clarified in the next sentence. "There were more who died from the hailstones than the children of Israel killed with the sword." That's the kind of stones that were sent from heaven. They were large hailstones. And this fact of the relative fatalities emphasizes again the first part of our message title: Yahweh is the warrior for Israel. Yes, they were involved. Yes, their army was engaged. But he killed more with the hailstones than they did with their swords. And that brings us to the place where we can consider the second part of our message title: the day God heeded a man. Verse 12 begins with a reference to prayer. "Then Joshua spoke to Yahweh in the day when Yahweh delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel." Now, that sounds like a rather routine introduction to a prayer, but the prayer itself is anything but routine. For the text continues, "And he said in the sight of Israel, 'Son, stand still over Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Aijalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped till the people had revenge upon their enemies. Now what immediately strikes us as not routine is who or what Joshua addresses in prayer. He speaks not to Yahweh, but he speaks directly to the sun and the moon. And we're told he does so in the sight of all Israel. So I think we're sort of to get a picture here that Joshua is in some prominent location where he can be seen by all. Perhaps he's lifting his hands toward the sky and he's giving commands to the sun and the moon. Well, what's going on here? Has Joshua become a sun or a moon worshiper? Well, not at all. But the question points to an important truth. Because there were those in the land of Canaan who did worship these heavenly bodies. This was worship which Israel was commanded to reject. And what Joshua shows here is that he, as Yahweh's servant, has greater power than these gods, so-called, of the Canaanites. But the earlier part of the verse indicates that Joshua spoke to Yahweh. But rather than speaking to him directly, he gives command to the sun and the moon with the expectation that the Lord will hear these commands and bring them about. This is bold, and we can only assume that the Spirit prompted him to make the address in this way. But what exactly is it that Joshua commanded and prayed for, and what exactly happened as a result? Well, one thing I learned in my studies this week is that there is no consensus on the answer to this question among Bible-believing commentators. In fact, I came across at least six different interpretations, of which I will present three for your consideration. The first proposal is that the sun and moon literally stopped their movement in order to extend daylight. Now, this is a traditional interpretation. It's been championed by the likes of Augustine, Luther, and Calvin. And the idea here is that extra daylight was needed so that the Israelite and Gibeonite forces could prolong the rout of their enemies. This is probably the most straightforward reading of our common English translations. And if the Lord accomplished this, what would it take? Well, at least from our understanding, sort of geophysics, he could have stopped the earth's rotation. And he would have miraculously kept everything from flying off the face of the earth into orbit, which is what would happen if the earth just suddenly stopped. And what we have to say is, the Lord could do that. And if that's what this text says, we absolutely affirm it. God can do that kind of miracle. A second view is interestingly like it with a twist. The sun and moon literally stopped their movement to extend darkness rather than light. This understands the purpose as just the opposite, not extending light, but extending darkness. Two commentators that I read, both of whom I studied under at Reformed Seminary, take this view with slightly different twists. Ralph Davis, for example, notes the locations of the sun and moon in verse 12. The sun is in the east over Gibeon. The moon is in the west over Aijalon. And he suggests that this would point to a time in the morning. You know, when the sun first comes up, you might still see the moon before it disappears. And this fits the idea that Joshua launched an early surprise attack under the cover of darkness. Now, one key to this view is that the word at the beginning of verse 12, the first word there that is translated then in the New King James translation, does not necessarily imply that this prayer was offered after the hailstorm of the previous verses. You read that, you sort of think, well, then what happened next? Well, after that, Joshua prayed. That's sort of what the traditional daylight interpretation reads. But the way the Hebrew word is used in this sentence introduces something that generally would be understood to have taken place at the same time as that of verses 6 through 11, not something that happened later. And this is reflected in some other translations. The ESV has at that time. The New Living Translation has on that day. The NIV and the CSB have on the day. So the picture here is that Joshua could have offered an early morning prayer for the extension of darkness that was then answered by the heavenly bodies standing still at appropriate places to extend that period of darkness to the advantage of the forces of Israel and Gibeon. Now, a third proposal goes in a different direction entirely, and that is that the hailstorm was the answer to Joshua's prayer. As with the second view, this view understands Joshua's prayer to have been offered in the morning but sees its answer in meteorological rather than in astronomical terms. But, you might ask, what does a hailstorm have to do with the sun and moon standing still? And that leads us to consider the verbs that are used here of the sun and moon. The Hebrew word translated stand still has a range of meaning. It can mean to cease, to be silent, to be cut off. Rather than the sun standing still, this language can refer to the sun ceasing to shine. As one scholar put it, the sun is not silent when it blazes forth from heaven, but when it does not shine. Like the second view, this understands the goal to involve darkness rather than the light, but the darkness would come as a result of the storm, which would cover the sun and moon, and because of which they would cease to shine down upon them. Now, biblical basis for linking the ceasing of the sun to a storm is found in a prophetic passage that refers back to this event in Joshua. We read in Habakkuk 3:11, "The sun and moon stood still," and again, that's that word that means ceased or be silent, "stood still in their habitation. At the light of your arrows they went, at the shining of your glittering spear." Okay, so you've got to put your poetry glasses on, right? And recognize, we're talking about Hebrew poetry, there's parallelism here. The sun and the moon standing still is parallel to the light of God's arrows and the shining of his glittering spear. Now, what do God's arrows and spears refer to poetically? Well, most likely lightning. We see that in a number of places in the Psalms. In the darkness of the storm, the only illumination for the soldiers was lightning. What Habakkuk says is, "At the light of your arrows they went, at the shining of your glittering spear." So the storm then was the occasion for the great stones from heaven, the great hailstones that killed so many enemy soldiers. Another line of reasoning that might point in this direction is the command in verse 11 for the sun and moon to stand still over specific places, Gibeon and the valley of Aijalon. We saw that the second view sort of took that into account. This does so in a different way, saying, well, it's really hard to imagine literally the sun and moon standing still over places, but it's very easy to imagine a storm settling in specific places where those enemy forces were to be found. On this view, the language of the sun and moon standing still, being silent, ceasing, is a poetic idiom for a catastrophic storm, in this case, a great hailstorm. And what's important to note here is that this still is a miraculous work of the Lord, especially since it was so timed and so positioned that only the enemy soldiers were killed and Israelite and Gibeonite soldiers then gained victory over them. Now, each of these views, and there are others, has evangelical proponents. Each can be grounded in a close study of the text of Joshua, and each also still leaves some questions hanging when you wrestle with the text. And so with Dr. Davis, I would suggest, I don't know that I can be completely dogmatic on which view to take. However, I think we can agree with the conclusion of our friend Roger Ellsworth, who writes in his commentary, "We do not need to determine the exact nature of the miracle to determine that one took place. And it took place because the sovereign God who made this world can step into it and suspend the natural laws that he himself put in place." Now, so often, that whole description there is the focus of study of this chapter. What happened with the sun and moon standing still and what happened in the hail? But what I think is very important to emphasize is what the text says. Clearly emphasizes. And listen to verse 14. "And there has been no day like that before it or after it that Yahweh heeded the voice of a man, for Yahweh fought for Israel." It doesn't say there has been no day before it or after it that was like it, when the sun and the moon stood still in the sky, or when great hailstones came down to grant victory for Israel. It says nothing like that has happened before, that the Lord heeded the voice of a man, and that doing so, the Lord fought for Israel. Now, this phrase translated, "heeded the voice," is a very strong statement with the connotation of obedience. Some translations even have obedience here, obeying. This is not just the Lord hearing, it is the Lord heeding. And the phrase only occurs three times in the Old Testament with Yahweh as its subject. The other two, first of all, Numbers 21:3. And Yahweh listened to, this is that same word heeded, the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities. And then 1 Kings 17:22, then Yahweh heeded the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came back to him, and he revived. Now Joshua 10:14 declares, there has been no day like that before it or after it that Yahweh heeded the voice of a man. In the example from Numbers 21, Yahweh heeds the voice of Israel, considered as a whole, not a single man. And the example from 1 Kings 17 comes from a time after the writing of Joshua, so that would not be in view in the statement in verse 14. Nevertheless, it shows how this language is used in the context of a great miracle. In Elijah's case, the resurrection of a child from the dead. Whatever happened with the sun, moon, and hail, the Spirit wants us to concentrate on the marvel of Yahweh heeding a man and therefore fighting for Israel. Now this exalts Joshua as Israel's leader like Moses before him, but even more it exalts Yahweh the Lord God as the victorious warrior for Israel. Now by way of application, I want to note two things. First of all is the significance of prayer. Our text in Joshua clearly emphasizes that the most significant thing that day was not the astronomical or meteorological phenomena, but the fact that God heeded the voice of a man and answered his prayer. Now, certainly Joshua had a unique role to fulfill that day. We are not invited by this passage to begin calling out commands to the sun or to the moon. But the fact remains that the Lord who created and sustains the universe is pleased to hear and answer our prayers, just as he did for Joshua. Matthew Henry makes this application from the passage. When our spiritual enemies set themselves in array against us and threaten to swallow us up, let us by faith and prayer apply to Christ, our Joshua, for strength and succor, as Paul did, and we shall receive the same answer of peace. My grace is sufficient for thee. The holy warfare in our day is a spiritual warfare against spiritual forces in high places. And the Lord will be as faithful in answering our prayers for help in the battles that we face as he was in answering Joshua's prayer. And this should encourage us and it should embolden our lives of prayer. So first of all, the significance of prayer. But secondly, our greater Joshua's victory for us on the cross. Matthew Henry calls Christ our Joshua. And it is good to remember that Jesus, whose name, by the way, is the Greek form of the Hebrew Joshua, is our greater Joshua. All that the Lord accomplished through Joshua in the conquest of the land was a shadowy prefiguring of greater things to be accomplished by Jesus. He is the one who directly commanded the wind and the waves, showing his control over nature. More significantly, he is the one who won a definitive victory over Satan and all the forces of darkness on the cross. Commentator John Currid makes this connection and he adds, and on that day, the day of the cross, the sun was once again involved, refusing to shine for three of the hours that Jesus was on the cross. During those hours, Jesus entered into the deepest darkness of all, the darkness of the wrath of God against sinners. He endured the darkness of that wrath so that all who receive him as their Lord and Savior will never have to experience that darkness themselves, a darkness that those who reject him will experience. As we marvel at God's exploits through Joshua in the conquest, let us give thanks for the greater conquest by the greater Joshua, through whom we have found salvation, life, and light, both for now and for all eternity.